This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Selepas pilihan raya umum 2008, rakyat Perak telah memilih Pakatan Rakyat untuk mentadbir negeri mereka. Lanjutan daripada itu, Datuk Seri Nizar telah dilantik sebagai Menteri Besar. Walau bagaimanapun, selepas tiga adun meletak jawatan dan mengumumkan kedudukan mereka sebagai ahli bebas, Datuk Seri Nizar, calon dari Pakatan Rakyat, telah disingkir dan Datuk Dr. Zamri, calon dari Barisan Nasional, telah diletak sebagai Menteri Besar baru. Justru, krisis politik di Perak bermula kerana Datuk Dr. Zamri dilihat sebagai seorang Menteri Besar yang bukan dilantik oleh rakyat.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. We're still staying at home to stay healthy and safe, and the folks behind the Freedom Film Fest are still releasing a specially curated Freedom Film playlist every weekend, which they've dubbed Weekend Watch with Freedom Film Fest, and this is happening on their YouTube channel. This so that we can all revisit the many thought-provoking films that have been released throughout the years through this amazing Human Rights Film Festival. So today we're going to revisit the film titled No Silver Lining, The Perak Crisis, which looks back at the events of the 2009 Perak constitutional crisis, when the Pakatan Rakyat-led Perak government collapsed after the defection of three assembly persons. And joining me to discuss this film are the film's directors, Sarah Sasha Abubakar and Sherry Razak Dali, who are both also lawyers. Welcome, ladies. How are you today?
Hi, Juliet.
Hi, Juliet. Thanks for inviting us.
An absolute pleasure. You guys, I just watched the film and I'm ashamed to say that it took me this long to watch it. But what an amazing film it was, you know, and really captured that really important part of our political history, in a 20-minute film. But, you know, before we get into that, both of you are, of course, lawyers. You're also partners, am I correct? With your own firm. Tell me a little bit about yourselves, for those of us who don't know.
We met in 2007, 2008, serving different various committees in the bar. Human Rights Committee is one of the platforms that we did a lot of work, and hence we got to know each other from there. And then we were then approached by Edmund Bon Tai Soon, actually. He was the chair of the Human Rights Committee back then, and he was one of the lawyers who were doing the case, the constitutional crisis at that time. And he approached us and asked us whether we want to do a documentary film. So the both of us, who has no experience, who has no, don't know what to do, and then we're like, okay, sure. Like, can you tell us what to do? We're like, okay, prepare a treatment. So we're like, okay, what's a treatment? So he said, don't worry, I'll get you a sample and then we'll just go on from that. So actually, we were submitting a proposal to the Freedom Film Festival to get a grant to do the film. So it's not just doing the film. So we submitted our treatment, a proposal, and then they vetted, I think, 30 or so applicants. And then we were shortlisted for interview. And three applicants were then shortlisted and granted the grant to do the film by the Freedom Film Fest. That's how we started. And we had no experience in filming, handling camera, directing. So we got a few friends, we asked who want to volunteer and help us out. So we got a few friends like Yohendra, Carmen, and a few more other people who volunteered to help us out. Anna Ha and Brenda was the producer, right? We went the first round for filming and we came back with really bad shots.
Oh no.
It was so bad. They got so rejected bad by them. They like go back to Ipoh and do, reshoot, oh my God.
But so
we didn't handle the camera at all. We were just directing. So Okay, FFN provided the equipment and provided the cameraman and editor to work with. So they helped us a lot with that kind of support. But we didn't know what was directing, how was directing. So we generally came up with the idea, the background story, the treatment in a sense, like where you can see the frog, the story, like the opening credit, right? We literally bought the frog and we thought like having, you know, 1 ringgit rolled up and having the frog jump being pushed by the 1 ringgit was a good opening scene. So those little stuff we did, and then we had the frog head walking. We thought like it is a character, you know, asking around as a protagonist, asking about going through the crisis, mm-hmm. and all going through the story. So a friend of ours got another help to create that frog head, styrofoam frog head. I still have the frog head in my house. So, and actually somebody, asked to purchase the frog head and we refused to sell the frog head.
Never sell it. I mean, just for, you know, the sake of those who haven't actually watched the film yet, basically, can I say who it was who was wearing the frog head?
Yes.
Sarah here was wearing a large styrofoam frog head, very beautifully done, and conducting interviews with, you know, MPs, with lawyers, with, you know, regular folk on the street. It was an amazing piece of work. And you were walking around, I understand, without being able to see anything with that frog head, but still asking really pertinent questions, right, Sarah?
Yes. Like the frog head has no hole for me to like look where I was going, who I was talking to. So it was a bit funny and awkward. I don't know whether it's for me or for the people who I interviewed also. But in terms of the question that I wanted to ask them, I could have looked down because, you know, then there's like some space for me to read the question. So that's fine. But if the person who I interviewed is going to look at me straight in frog's eyes, I basically can't see how they reacted. So for me, just do the question and then get their answer for it. And then the cameraman or Sherry, who can see the whole thing, will see how they reacted or whether, you know, should I ask more important question or more question that can provoke them to give a better answer lah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the use of the frog head is to talk about katas, right? Which, as we know, correct. In the Malaysian political context, is those who jump parties and, you know, cause. And that's pretty much what happened in Perak, you know, back in, I guess the events were in 2008, right? It came to be known as the 2009 Perak constitutional crisis. For those of us who have forgotten what happened there, can one of you remind us about, you know, the events that went down?
Okay, so basically, general election in 2008. So Perak, Pakatan got into power, but then three assemblymen decided to go independent. So it kind of like shift the power. Mm-hmm. So then Pakatan lost its majority and Barisan took over. So because of that, there were a bit of a riot, if I can use that word, by the people of Perak, because they were not happy about it. Just like what happened right now, 12 years later, you voted for someone, you gave the mandate for someone to do their job. And then halfway through their job, they decided to like, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm just going to leave and then someone else take over, which I never give you the mandate to do so. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened in Perak. You know, at that time was the Menteri Bensar, YB Nizar. I think he filed a suit, just like Sherry said earlier, where Edmund Bond was helping him out filing the suit. In fact, we sometimes followed Edmund Bond to court to hear the proceedings. There were a lot of constitutional questions involved, which led us to do the documentary also, because a lot of lay person were asking, but the court say like this, but the constitution say like this, the state constitution say like this. How can this fellow do that? How can this fellow do this? So as a lawyer, as a trained lawyer, both of us can grasp the issue you know, quite easily.
Yeah.
But for the lay person, it's, you have to explain to them in a more simpler language. So we thought when Edmund Bond came up with the idea to do that documentary, so we had to, like, you know, compress the whole issues, like you said, Juliet, in 20 minutes and, you know, get the message across.
And it was so well done because, you know, there's you know.
Thank you. I mean, a lot of work involved.
I can tell. I can really tell because, you know, you're simplifying, you know, all these different state constitutional laws, you know, things to do with royalties involvement, things to do with, you know, federal versus state politics. So much was in there. But also at the same time, you spoke to locals, you know, you got, you spoke to the people of Perak themselves, you know, to get their side of the story. And I do understand that, you know, while you were trying to make the film, you also reached out to the Barisan National side, but they did not sort of grant you any interviews. Am I correct?
Yes,
correct, correct.
Yeah, okay. So that's why
actually, when we went on to the ground to interview the folks, we were quite surprised that they're more than willing to talk about it. So I suppose, you know, the anger is there, the sense of betrayal is there. So when they see someone who's like giving them the platform, you know, to speak, they just grab it, you know. Bear in mind that back then, 12 years ago, I suppose social media was not that popular compared to now.
Yeah.
So now you have, well, back then we have Twitter, but with all this enhanced new update, like you can do Twitter Live, you can do Twitter Space, you know. So everyone is a netizen now. All right.
Yeah.
But back then, 12 years ago, all these folks, you know, if they're not happy with their MPs, those three MPs, for instance, where do they go? Sure, they can go to Facebook, you know. But back then, social media is not as explosive as it is now. Like now you do the same thing, things can go viral, you know, just like what happened these past few days, right?
Yeah.
Whatever you say, whatever the minister said, you know. If they're not happy, if it's in breach of the SOP, it just went viral, you know? Mm-hmm. So back then, when we go on the ground and we start to interview people, they were quite happy to, like, voice out their concern. So I think it was a good thing back then.
It was really great. And I think what I like especially was the range of people that you spoke to. You know, there was uncles, there was, you know, people from the Orang Asli community, old, young,
yeah.
You know, just regular folks in the street, right? Because so often we don't listen to what they want to say. And I think, and I'm guessing that's
exactly
something that you wanted to portray in this film as well.
Yeah.
And we went to like the markets, we went to the Padang, we went to different areas, and it wasn't planned. Like, we were deciding, like, okay, let's go here and ask questions. Like, let's see where we can ask. Like, just randomly approach people on the street, you know, like, and ask. Like, but the Orang Asli community, we did ask someone, like, you know, where to go. So, hence, we interviewed, I believe it was Tija and her community, and we went there. Actually, there were a lot more interviews, but we couldn't fit, you know, all of it because the time constraint, right?
Yeah.
20 minutes, we had to fit everything in. And it's so much information. We were actually struggling figuring out how to best showcase the story and to make it understandable within that short frame of 20 minutes because it's quite complex. And there's so many stuff that you need to put, like, there's news, there's so many incidents even within the crisis, right? Like the speaker being dragged out on his chair, you know, the protests at the tree. We went to the tree.
Tree assembly, right?
Yeah. And it's the famous tree assembly, and someone brought us there to show the tree and talk about the tree, what happened at the tree. So we went around and asked to understand ourselves for the film. But it's also to see what people feel. And there were so many anger even and upsetness. Like what happened. And it's not just in Ipoh. We went to Kuala Kangsa as well. Because, you know, the incident, the protest, people protesting on the street, lying down on the road, you know.
Yeah. Blocking the Istana. I was, you know, I never seen that. That was really something very eye-opening for me as well.
Yeah, so we wanted those things to come out because back then, like what Sarah said, like, you don't have immediate social media response.
Yeah.
Like people don't miss out all these things and don't realize, oh, this happened, like, you know, all those things. So it's really, we were quite pleased, although it was our first film, and without experience, we managed to get the story out.
And again, I will say it's really well done. And when we come back from this quick break, I'm going to talk to you about, you know, all the different sort of footage that you use and the music that you used, you know, all of that to create that film. That's coming up after this quick break. I'm speaking today to Sarah Sasha Abubakar and Sherry Razat Dali. They're both lawyers. They're also the directors of the short film No Silver Lining, The Perak Crisis, which, you know, took a look at the 2009 Perak constitutional crisis. We'll come back after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
In my right hand is just a blue pill, and in my left hand is just a red pill. If you take the blue pill, you'll end up on this side. And if it's a red pill, you'll find yourself on the other side. But actually, both will bring you either way.
Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and joining me today are Sarah Sasha Abubakar and Sherry Razat Dali. They're both lawyers. They're also filmmakers, and they were behind the 2009 film No Silver Lining, The Perak Crisis, which, you know, took a look at the events of the 2009 Perak constitutional crisis when the Pakatan Rakyat-led Perak government collapsed after the defection of three assembly persons. So they put together, you know, no pun intended, I'm sure, right? No Silver Lining. I love the title. And there were so many wonderful elements in this film, you guys. You know, you spoke to lawyers, you spoke, like we spoke about before the break, you spoke to people on the ground. But let's talk about the lawyers now and all the different people that you approached to sort of like simplify this for the public, right? Who did you approach to kind of, to kind of help in that process?
I think we interviewed back then there was the bar president, which is Raguna Kesavan. And because the bar, I think, took a lot of position and was following the legal suit closely because it's a constitutional case. And then we interviewed Sharizan Johan when he was much younger. And I think we also interviewed Sahadeva. And we even interviewed Zaid Ibrahim at his house back then as well to get his point of view. So there was a few lawyers that we did interview for the film.
And of course, you know, aside from the lawyers, you also spoke to MPs themselves. You even spoke to YB Niza himself. Sherry, as you said, you interviewed him while wearing a frog head. I mean, how did you manage to secure all these different interviews with the MPs themselves?
I believe our main contact who really, really helped us was Edmund Bond. Mm-hmm. Because he had access to all these persons, so he introduced them to us. So when we requested for interview, and they agreed, we were given dates and location to go and meet them. So that's how it goes for most of these people. But the rest, like, probably is our own friends, and we know them ourselves, and other than the public, it was just off the cuff. We went and interviewed them directly on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, when you guys were making the film, right, I mean, what did you hope that people would take away from it? I mean, yes, you wanted them to understand the constitutional crisis, right? But what else were you hoping that audience would take away from everything that you presented?
I just want people to understand how important it is that you know the law, and then that you can't just simply breaking it without facing any consequences. You know, that's one thing. Another thing, I suppose, there must be some sort of responsibility for those in the, for those politicians or for those who claim they want to serve the rakyat. So then I wanted the rakyat also to see that if they do that, these are the options that you have. You know, these are the consequences that they have to face. Apart from raising the awareness about the constitution, about the constitution in general, I feel that is what I wanted from the documentary.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Sherry?
Well, it's definitely one way of advocacy and awareness to the public, because a lot of people may not understand the issue. One is put aside the legal issue, but the issue on its own, the chronology, the facts, and what transpired, that's a lot of things happened within that short frame of time. And so we want to capture that as well. We wanted to understand that ourselves before we put it in the film, because there's so many facts or stuff coming in. So we had to compile that, and we wanted the public to understand it as easy as they can. So, and the legal issue is also quite tricky and quite complicated, even for lawyers to understand and argue. So it was quite complex to bring it out there for the public to understand. So we try our best to show and bring out the story as it is.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take you guys to put the film together in total? Yeah,
I think 3 months. Was it, Sarah? 3 months? It was 3 or 4 months, because we remembered we were working with people, and then
the shooting basically takes about 5 days for you to get all the materials. If you look at the treatment, 5 days are allocated to do the shooting, get the interview done, you know, all that thing. But it's the editing process that took such a long time. At least we need about at least 2 months, like Sherry said. Mm-hmm. So maybe the first month is all those preparation, shooting, you know, doing research, get all the interviews, you know, talk to people, rearranging the timetable and all that. And the next 2 months is editing it, getting the materials, you know. Mm-hmm. What do you put while the people talk? Do you want to put a visual at the back? You know, what about music? You know, that kind of thing.
And so, transcribing. What's up?
Transcribing. Doing the subtitle for the YouTube also, oh, wow, you know. Yeah. Those are the behind-the-scene work that takes a lot of time. So shooting, basically, you can do it like within a day or two, you know. If you're not happy with it, just go back. Mm-hmm. But the editing process is like, oh my God, you just sit down in a dark room, for instance, and then do your editing, do the transcribing. We sat with the editor and also our sound guy also lah, to decide what to put, what kind of music we like, you know, that what is the mood for the whole documentary, that kind of thing. So that took about 2 months lah, I think.
And the music is something I want to talk about as well, because it's a lot of local rock music, you know, really gets you like, wow, really into the whole like feeling, and really gets you involved in what's going on there. Why did you go with that sort of selection of music?
We managed to get help from Joe Kidd, and Joe Kidd is a legend on his own. So Joe was kind enough to assist us to get this collection of music arrangements and their consent to use for the film. So it was actually a lot of punk music to give it a different vibe compared to other documentaries, and to reflect the two of us as well, because it's not so serious. It is a serious documentary, but a different feeling of vibe of intensity to the documentary. So I think the music is quite important to bring emotions, to bring out what we are trying to show. And it's also showcasing our own local talents in our documentary.
Yeah, a lot of punk music is protest music anyway, if you want to look at it that way. So yeah, like I said, it really, really added to the mood of it. So, you know, it's been more than a decade, but I think that crisis remains just as relevant, because we've seen similar scenarios, have we not, repeated in several states following, especially the regime changes in the 2018 general election. How do you feel about that? You know, the fact that, do you feel that your film is still, you know, just as relevant as it was 12 years ago?
Definitely. We were asked to do another film to get the Froghead out. And I think that after Langkah Sheraton, some of our friends even asked to get the Froghead to appear at the Istana.
That Froghead needs to be replicated.
So we're like, okay, no, we're not going to go stand at the Istana with the Froghead. I mean, it's similar incidents. The story is about to say is still relevant, you know, and it's part of our archive, and which you can't access the same story. You can't even get it in mass media. Mm. You don't get it on local channels, the story as it is. So it's bits and pieces, but we managed to compile it and make it into documentary for people to remember as well, to learn.
Yeah, I mean, it's really like a timestamp of what happened then. And, you know, unfortunately, we've seen it happen throughout. And, you know, as both of you as lawyers, right, you know, there have been so many calls for anti-hopping laws and things like that. But we're nowhere near to seeing that come to fruition. Am I right?
Yes. Yep. Correct.
Definitely. And we actually, when we were doing the film, we were also volunteering to do urgent arrest during the rallies. There were a lot of mass arrests during the Perak crisis. So on top of it, we were making the film. We were also on standby, urgent arrest for that. I remember at one point we were coming from Perak, coming back, and then we heard our friends were arrested at Brickfield. So we drove straight to Brickfield's police station, and our friends, the lawyers, were arrested that night. That was part of the mass arrest during that period.
That was the climate back then. You know, there were a lot of arrests. If you protest or if you're not happy, and then you wanted to, I don't know, gather and then voice your anger or whatever, even writing a blog or giving a comment, the next thing you know, the police is at your doorstep. You know, they wanted to arrest you. So similar climate is happening right now, I feel, you know, but it's a bit different because you can't physically protest. So what you do is that you do all these virtual protests, which also still caught the government's attention, because then after that, they came out with a completely different narrative, because in social media now is the only way that you can control the narrative, because you can't go on the road physically, right?
Yep.
So then I think now the climate, I don't know whether it's much worse than back then.
I think back then they don't have CMA.
Mm-hmm.
True CMA also.
So back True then it was sedition charges.
Yeah. Correct, yeah. Correct. So back then it was sedition charges, for instance. Was the ISA or something else was back then also?
Yeah, still, okay, there, so yeah.
Still there, yeah.
There's that threat. Fast forward 12 years later, we still have this thing. The ISA comes in a version 2.0 under SOSMA, you know? And then we have the CMA also, that kind of thing. So all these threats are looming if you decided to like protest or do something. Not if you're not happy with the government. So those are the climate back then and also now. Back then, we had to rush to the police station. We had to, like, you know, help out with our friends and all that. But I feel 12 years later, people are more educated due to all this advocacy work that the bar has done 10 years ago. So you don't see the same, well, I wouldn't say the same pool of people. You don't see me and Sherry also rushing over to the police station, because now we have the new generation, we have the new group of lawyers taking this up, you know. So they are more than capable people who can do this.
And more organized, lah. Because now
in more organized way, because after 10 years, the bar council has compartmentalized the committee, who's in charge, and you know, come up with how to do it, you know, so to speak, lah.
Mm-hmm. You know how to do it already, lah. You're unfortunately very well versed in how to handle these cases, because it's not alien anymore. It's quite a common thing, unfortunately, right?
Yes, correct.
Yes. We've been stuck at it with tear gas before.
Oh,
so
dear.
Yeah, we've been on the streets before monitoring the rallies throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, luckily not facing arrest yourself, but, you know, helping all of those who have been arrested. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you know, for anyone listening, 20 wonderful minutes, you know, for a look back at history, you know, a constitutional crisis that no one saw coming, right? Especially after that change in the political scene in Pera, you know, less than a year, all of this happened, and it you know, has set a, I don't know if it set a precedent, but, you know, at least you kind of know some things that might happen following this, right? It was really quite, the fallout from it was amazing. Sorry?
it's definitely created a precedent, you know. You can take a chapter out of it, and then you know what to do next. And then you can sort of like anticipate what to do next. But like I mentioned earlier, 12 years ago, climate is slightly different and the set of law are also slightly different. Mm-hmm. But the playbook is still there, you know. People copying from a party, then, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, with this slim majority, you just never know, isn't it?
And that's correct.
Yeah, but okay. So, you know, that film is now available on the Freedom Film Fest YouTube channel. You know, any last message that the both of you would like to leave us with before we go, you know, encouraging people to watch it?
Well, it's been 12 years. I mean, it was our first film. There are some, it was our first experience. But go on and watch it. I mean, it's not perfect documentary, but we wanted the message out. We wanted the story out. That's the whole intention. And we did our best to bring out the story in our own version, in our own style that reflects the two of us. So, yeah.
My message is basically after 12 years, after this documentary come out, is to terus bangkit, terus lawan.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Sarah Sasha Abubakar and Sherry Razak Dali. They're both lawyers and also the filmmakers behind No Silver Lining, The Perak Crisis. Again, if you want to watch that, just head to the Freedom Film Fest YouTube channel, search for that, and you can find it there. And if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, just search for the podcast on the BFM app or at bfm.my/learn. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Change. I want change, you want change. He wants change, she wants change. Everyone knows we need a change. Change, change, change. I want change, you want change. Change.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.